The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Have you ever tried to buy friends? The United States is trying to do so. It doesn't work on a personal level. It doesn't work socially or politically, yet we still try it internationally. And it doesn't seem to make sense to me. We assume we can purchase loyalty by sending aid, food, weapons to Arab states around Israel, at the same time supporting Israel. We assume we can purchase loyalty in the years and years that we have sent a flood of aid, even including in this emergency food shipment some years ago, to stave off imminent starvation of millions of people in the nation of India. Every kind of help, every kind of aid. The Uncle Sam, that sometimes has been called Uncle Sap, has been an absolute giveaway on a giveaway program of unparalleled precedence and heights in all of the world's history for as long as I can remember. It seems like we are willing to give away anything we've got, even before, in some cases, we give away sophisticated weapons to our own military organizations and establishments. We send arms, we send technicians, we send food, we send aid in the form of direct monetary grants and loans, easy credit and the like. We just give away everything to foreigners, and then we are always so strangely miffed when they turn around and rend us, and when they turn their backs on us, and when they bite the hand that feeds them. Yet we continue to go around the world trying to find where can we give away some more of our national substance and strength. Are we living in a time of the strange repetition of history? For many, many years, I have been saying the United States was on a collision course with Japan. We have tried now to hedge our bets in the Middle East by giving away military hardware and aid to the neighbors around Israel who are members of OPEC, the oil producers. Japan is deeply involved, of course, with Arab oil, depending upon almost to the 100% mark, Arab crude for its own industries to be fueled. Japan is now talking about a stronger military. Japan is also reversing her position and spoke very strongly in the person of Prime Minister Miki the other day concerning the Arab states and the just claim of the Arabs concerning the West Bank, the Sinai, even telling the Israeli government that she, Japan, thought some early solution should come to the what is called Jerusalem problem. In a major address to Parliament, Mr. Miki called on Israel to withdraw from Arab territory occupied since the war, and urged recognition of the just rights of the Palestinians and a solution to the Jerusalem problem, thus disclosing a stronger pro-Arab policy toward the Middle East for his nation, reflecting the Japanese government's anxieties over oil prices and supplies. The Japanese know there is no alternative but Middle Eastern oil. They also know that the juggler of Japan is very, very susceptible to the Arab scimitar in the form of oil, and they learned a lesson in the one-day token stoppage way back in about 71 or 2, whenever it was, and also other members of the oil consumers were quite miffed back in those days prior to any real awareness of an energy crisis, when Japan proved itself willing to pay an exorbitant price for a short period of time above the price that others were willing to pay for a barrel of Arab crude. Very recently now, leaders in the American government have been warning Japan about any private, go-it-alone oil price deals with the Arabs. Years and years ago, I said that Japan was destined to move into any power vacuum in Asia. People were scared half to death about Red China. I said, nonsense. With the industrial base of Japan, they could move into a gigantic nuclear power with far more suddenness and more sophisticated weapons than could Red China, and they could do it in a tiny fraction of that amount of time. Japan is an industrial and an economic giant, but a political and military dwarf, to echo the words of Franz Josef Strauss, who said the same thing of Western Germany and wondered how long West Germany could remain so. Well, Japan's time of being a military dwarf, but an economic and industrial giant, has just about run out. Mr. Miki has gone well beyond the position of some of his predecessors in urging Japanese to support their nation's military forces. He said, "I do not side with those who advocate an unarmed Japan." He said, "In the light of world realities and the prevailing international common sense, keeping Japan in a vacuum in terms of defense capabilities, in spite of her massive influence on the world, would constitute a factor detrimental to the cause of stability in the Asian Pacific region. Years and years ago, when I was only a small boy, there were rumbles of all kinds of troubles out of the Asian Pacific area. There was the Japanese idea of the Greater Southeast Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere. Those were words of that day, not a bit unlike some of the moves today of economic blocks of mutual prosperity on the part of those of, say, the common market. And, of course, Japan and her trading partners all around the world, though not in such a tight-knit pact as was conceived then. Historians in Japan will comment, not without a little acidity, that when President Roosevelt's administration tried to force the Japanese out of Red China, the Japanese were trying their best to prevent a communist takeover of Red China. And, of course, history bears that out somewhat, though the Japanese no doubt had aims of conquest and aims of control of the area of their own. That may have been a side issue. Nevertheless, it was a real issue, all right. They knew that communist forces were trying to take over China. Well, you know, at that time, Japan was a heavy trading partner with the United States. She had other similarities, that is, that she had to rely upon raw materials from the United States, from South America, from certain African areas, primarily from Southeastern Asia, Indonesia as it is today, or the Dutch East Indies, and the oil, the tin, and the rubber of the Dutch East Indies and of Burma and Malaya. And as a matter of practical fact, when the Japanese launched their unbelievably risky World War II by attacking the United States at Pearl Harbor, their initial attempt was to interdict or to intercept the United States fleet rather than to actually invade the United States and occupy it. They were hoping to buy themselves sufficient time to gain the raw materials to build up even greater and superior military forces, and certainly hoping that the war would go very badly for the United States in the other part of the world, knowing in alliance with the Axis powers of Italy and of Germany that Japan had some very powerful militarist allies to back her play. But when she bombed almost simultaneously Honolulu and Clark Field, she was striking at two of the major bases in the United States' sphere of influence in the Asian Pacific area in order to prevent American interference as the Japanese forces launched invasion troops into those areas where the rubber, the tin, and the oil was coming from. It would seem to me that history ought to teach us something. Now, here we see the United States, and of course everybody applauds that because that's supposed to be justified when we say it, in the form of our Secretary of State, who in the interview with Business Week would not rule out the use of force at some future time in the Middle East should strangulation of the American economy appear imminent. Let us view that for just a moment, if we could, in the backdrop of what the United States did to Japan prior to World War II. Japan was heavily dependent upon the United States for certain raw materials, iron and even scrap iron, for example. Japan was heavily invested in U.S. industries, Japanese assets in banks and lending institutions around the country were quite prolific, even as they are today, except, of course, today is mammoth, gigantic in comparison with then. We're dealing in terms of pennies compared with billions when you look at the actual repetition of history that's happening. Because back in those days, while I don't have any statistics right here on exactly how much money was frozen in U.S. banks, I know that did occur. And so by comparison, this second time around is far more so than ever before. So we didn't like the Japanese invasion into the Chinese area, and we didn't like what Japan was doing with regard to trade. We didn't like some of the Japanese politics of the day, and we tried to force Japan, which was then a very powerful maritime as well as a powerful naval army and Air Force, because they had separate units, Army and Navy Air Force, but they were a very powerful military power, and we knew that. Actually had a bigger fleet than we did, with more powerful ships, more efficient submarines, better torpedoes, they had better aircraft and more of them. They were a gigantic military power. So the United States, by use of embargo, cooperating with our own allies, Britain, the Netherlands, of course, even though there was a a government which was now in exile, Dutch East Indies were at that time still free and under that government, and therefore cooperating with the United States. So those areas then ruled by the French, such as in today's Indochina or Saigon and Hanoi, which was in the hands of the French during World War II days, and with a collected might of the United States, Britain, and France, just about having sole authority and control of all of that periphery of the world, of the Mediterranean, India, where Britain ruled, the big British naval bases at Trincomalee, at Colombo and Ceylon, at the Straits of Malacca, Hong Kong, Singapore, all of these were huge British bastions that were occupied by British troops and with British and American naval units available. And the same comment for all of the Dutch East Indies, the islands all the way down, stepping down to Australia, or New Zealand, the islands of the South Pacific. So the United States, Britain, and France combined together to pretty much slap an embargo, which was nothing short of strangulation. In short, we did then the same thing to the Japanese in terms of cutting off their raw materials as the Arabs did recently to the United States, to Japan, and to Europe. Now, we are saying in the terms of our Secretary of State that we will not rule out the use of force to go and get the raw materials to fuel our industries if the Arabs cut them off. The Japanese said exactly the same thing in about 1937. They said about exactly the same thing, and that's exactly what they did. Now, right or wrong, and I'm not arguing that, because a sneak attack at Pearl Harbor could never be justified in any humanistic terms or any historical terms, one way or the other. It was wrong, pure and simple. But I'm talking about causal factors. Reasons, all right, call them excuses, if you will. But it does not make sense in a bizarre game among nations that one nation at one time may use an excuse or a reason, if you would prefer, for launching an aggressive attack against another nation, which it would say is a desperate measure to preserve and to protect the much-needed raw materials or the supplies without which that nation simply cannot survive, which was true in the case of Japan. She had exactly 3.5 years to survive under peacetime conditions and about 2.5 or less under wartime conditions simply because of the enormously heightened consumption of those raw materials on a wartime footing. And she knew this. If the United States said to itself, we've got exactly 3 years to survive, then we go down the drain, or else we've got to attack the Arabs to get the oil forcibly. What do you think our course would be? Well, now, maybe we're so different, we'd go ahead and wait it out and see. Maybe we've lost all of our backbone and all of our resolve. I don't know about that. And I'm talking from the standpoint, not from a biblical or a New Testament point of view, but from a national point of view, looking at the Old Testament more, I suppose, and from the point of view of ancient Israel, which was ruled by a king and which had a standing army. And after all, the United States is a physical, material, earthly nation with its army, Marine Corps, and Air Force, its Navy, and dependent entirely upon its protection for its military establishments instead of upon its God. I'm just asking and commenting on the bizarre repetition of history now. Are we seeing a strange repetition of history? Japan's becoming an industrial giant, but is still a military dwarf. Now, just the other day, as if to add fuel to the fire, we see some Americans down in Houston working for a big Japanese firm, and they allege and are going to court to try to prove the case, discrimination against American employees and Japanese subsidiaries inside the United States, saying that they are being labeled, the Japanese are getting better work hours, they're working at night, making more money, that they get the rewards, they get the raises, they get the promotions, they get fringe benefits. So all of this is happening now, too, and no doubt that's immediately going back to the parent company in Japan, which immediately goes on up into the political hopper there to be considered by, no doubt, the Prime Minister himself. In the meantime, American leadership is now threatening surtaxes, quotas, restrictions. There have been literal shouting matches way back during the Kennedy Round tariff meetings between Japanese and American interests. I have said and characterized what is happening inside the United States that Japan has virtually already invaded the United States, except I was merely pointing to the trade invasion that has occurred. The absolute outpouring, the flowing into the United States of hundreds of thousands of Suzukis and Toyotas and Hondas and Subarus and all the Kawasakis, all the transistor radios, the watches, even suits and leather goods, clothing, shoes, all kinds of fabrics, crockery, silverware, almost everything you pick up anymore says made in Japan. Appliances, you name it, common everyday American things like California pottery that says made in Japan. I told the story of the Indians on a reservation up in, I think, South Dakota, a Sioux Indian reservation where the kids wanted to buy the little feathered tomahawk. This was years and years ago. The Indians couldn't even compete with the Japanese. You buy the little feathered tomahawk for your kid, it's supposed to be a genuine Sioux Indian little wooden tomahawk, you know, with a little dyed feather plucked out of a goose or something. And the kids go away happily, screaming like Indians with a little headdress. The headdress and the tomahawk say, made in Japan. It's unbelievable. It's been an absolute avalanche of trade pouring into the United States. And it's good stuff. You know, it's true that some of the Japanese models available on the United States market right now get 39 miles to the gallon, more than any American automobile. And there are hundreds of thousands of Americans driving Japanese cars and using Japanese motorcycles and recreational vehicles and even flying Japanese aircraft. I mean, that little Mitsubishi, they have an MU-2 and the MU-2J. They're the fastest among all of the turboprop in corporate aviation fleets right now today. They're faster than the King Air 100. And I guess they do quite a job. I have never flown one myself, but some of those very close to me have, and we're even looking at one, speculating about the possibility they may want to use it sometime. An awful lot of firms use it. It's a very sophisticated and, I guess, a very economical little aircraft. I understand they're a little noisy, and there are a few things here and there that balance out, but, you know, people that are in the business of buying very expensive corporate turboprop aircraft have to balance out their needs and the elevation, the distances, and the number of people they want to carry, and the maintenance and the fuel costs and all of that type of thing. I'll just say this, it's been very competitive and an awful lot of them are flying. A lot of them have been sold and apparently the users are pretty happy with them. So it's been just about like a trade invasion in that sense, because Japanese goods are no longer little cute trinkets, little paper mache playthings, little kind of china and decorative bric-a-brac, like it was to a large extent prior to World War II, but now even heavy machinery and equipment, sophisticated aircraft, as I said, clothing and fabric, shoes, automobiles, motorcycles, transistors, appliances, almost everything you could use. I have no doubt whatsoever you could walk into a very glittering, beautiful American home today, and you could probably find that the foundation was built with Japanese steel for rebar, that some of the building materials had come to us from Japan, synthetics and the like, which had gobbled up Oregon and Washington lumber, and come back to us in the form of building materials, siding and so on. You could probably find out that the wallpaper, the carpets, I know, the drapes, and even the appliances, even though bearing a major American label, might have their components inside of them made in Japan. You might find the communication system of the home. I don't know whether they're in air conditioning in this country or not, but it wouldn't surprise me. But in short, you could walk into what you think is a medium-income American home with a glittering kitchen and all the appliances and just about find out that everything, including the home itself, is labeled made in Japan. And all the clothes worn by the people, the dishes they eat out of, and the silverware they use. Now, I'm not saying that's bad, because in international competition, nations do and should, I guess, trade abroad. By the same token, you can find people using American goods, equipment, and machinery in all parts of the world, and particularly if the Americans have not been far ahead of other countries in, I think, design as well as in production. In the aviation field in particular, you wouldn't see aviation companies or airlines around the world using Douglas and Lockheed and primarily Boeing aircraft almost everywhere you look. But it doesn't really balance out because the United States has been losing in this trade battle that's going on. And now we see the stage set for the potential of a trade war. Harsh words being spoken, Japan, I have said for years and years, is eventually going to become again a gigantic military power. and not just necessarily a conventional military power alone, maybe a non-conventional one, because the weaponry of today is becoming far more sophisticated than just even the means to deliver nuclear warheads in terms of IRBMs and ICBMs. There are other huge breakthroughs in arms, one of which I think is going to drastically change naval warfare, and that harks back to the days of the Pacific, when the Japanese had a gigantic submarine fleet, even including two-man midget submarines, which could be carried piggyback on mother vessels, larger diesel-powered craft. In those days, of course, the submarines were diesel-powered, and they had to surface to charge their batteries, well known by people who studied the history of that day. Today, everything has changed. As a matter of fact, recently, a retired Navy captain who served in submarines in World War II wrote in a recent publication on naval weapons that these weapons are going to drastically change naval warfare. And he talked about accurate attack ranges which are afforded the nuclear submarine by its missiles it can carry, which are anti-ship missiles, and also wire-guided homing torpedoes that would require a tremendously excessive number of international units for protection of even a small number of merchant ships in any future battle where a war were waged on the high seas between submarine forces deployed to sink transport vessels or vessels bringing raw materials or supplies to a beleaguered country. And when you couple this wire-guided torpedo to a nuclear submarine, it has an accurate range 10 times that of a conventional torpedo fired from visual distances. So with this guidance system supplied from sound bearings on the propulsion noise of the ship being attacked, it could be used at very deep submergence, never exposing any part of the submarine above the surface of the water. So all of the old ASW tactics, anti-submarine warfare tactics, trying to spot a portion of the submarine, maybe the whole ship if it were surface to attack, but sometimes they did for torpedo attacks, and other times the periscope. Now the day of seeing the submarine before it attacks is over. With nuclear submarines operated efficiently and discreetly, there would be very few opportunities of forces spotting periscopes or masts compared to past experience against conventional diesel-driven submarines. I again remind you that Japan is a super technology, that the Japanese lead the world in many significant areas in technology. I believe they were the very first to develop the seeing telephone, for example, where you dial a number and where you can actually look at the person who is talking on the other end by the hookup of a television transmitter and receiver in connection with the telephone. It's actually been done. In Japan, they have had some of the most significant breakthrough in miniaturization, the transistors that have been used in communications and electronics of any other country on the face of the earth, and they do have many nuclear reactors. They are capable in a very quick time of converting a lot of their energies over into military hardware and becoming a truly powerful supergiant among the military forces of this earth. I say that the United States of America and Japan are on a collision course, and eventually so will Europe and Japan find themselves on a collision course. There is a prophecy that I've cited many times recently that gives more of an overview of what's happening in the world today than perhaps any other, which is Daniel, the 11th chapter, beginning in about the 40th verse, that talks about a king of the north, which I believe to be a coming superpower bloc inside Europe to consist of at least 10 nations, which will be a third power bloc to arbitrate between the East and the West, which will emerge, if not out of the confines of the present European economic community. It doesn't necessarily need to be the birthplace of this coming United States of Europe. It could include Greece and Turkey. It could include Spain and Portugal. It could include any number of countries, even presently not in the EEC. But that is, I believe, the power identified as the King of the North, who will attack the countries around Israel, occupying Israel, apparently for peaceful purposes, going in there apparently to guarantee the territorial integrity and the future security of the Jewish people. Very likely to internationalize the city of Jerusalem and to enforce that because of the presence of armed troops. And I believe, too, that Bible prophecy also shows that there will be strong religious overtones to all of this, since Jerusalem is, first of all, a spiritual capital to three of the world's great religions, Christianity, the religion of Islam, and Orthodox Jewry. The Muslims claim that that very spot where the Dome of the Rock presently sits is the spot from which Muhammad went to heaven. The Jews say that's the very rock where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac, and they also say, among the Christians in the Christian religion, that that is the spot from which Jesus went to heaven. And so, the three major religions have deep interests inside the city of Jerusalem as well. The Bible seems to imply very strongly that a great spiritual leader is going to show up in that city of Jerusalem and actually claim to be more than just a representative of God, but even claim to be God reincarnated in the human flesh. God come down to the earth, sitting in a temple of God. Maybe it'll be a beginning structure, maybe a cornerstone, maybe a tent, maybe an actual temple, maybe the present Dome of the Rock taken over. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But I do know 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, says that such a thing is going to occur. But interestingly enough, after that occurs, and this European power has moved into the Middle East, that prophecy of Daniel 11 says, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. There's going to come a reaction from some of the powerful countries north and east of Palestine. And that can only mean the Orient as well as the Soviet Union. And that's talking about the trigger which will actually ignite World War III, being sparked by some action on the part of these countries of Egypt. It talks about Libya. It talks about the countries, meaning Middle Eastern countries, with the exception of Jordan, possibly the exception of Iraq and Iran. Though that is speculation because not all of those are totally identified in that prophecy. We live right now in the incredible time of the repetition of history. This may as well be 1936 or 37 or 38 or 39. Take your pick. We live in a time of growing hostility, strained relations between the United States and its allies and its friends. We're trying to buy friends around the world. We've never been able to do it. You're going to find sometime in the future growing chilly climate between the United States and major European powers and between the United States and Japan. You're going to find eventually disruption of trade, eventually possibly even nationalization of assets and industries, and again the freezing of assets in U.S. banks. And eventually you may find the severing of diplomatic relations, and I believe that all of these things are leading right toward another conflict, and it seems to be inevitable the way the world is going. Now, I would hope that that doesn't have to happen. I would hope there would be some way to solve these problems very, very much short of that. I would certainly hope that given today's nuclear capacity, that nations would use wisdom and discretion, that they would not try to solve conflicts by resorting to military means. But with all the saber-rattling going on today, with at least five wars going on right now, and the threat of other wars, it looks to me like you're living in the time of which Jesus spoke, that you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. But he said, be not troubled, the end is not yet. Well, you need your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth, and you can have it by return mail if you will just get these articles on Tidal Wave of Red Ink Screens, U.S. Economy, The English Sickness, articles right now on the Shah of Iran and the Middle East. So if you write for The Plain Truth, it's absolutely free of charge, there is no price. Find out whether or not it's really what it says it is, The Plain Truth. There's no request for money, there's no follow-up, no one's going to call on you unless you, of course, request it first. So be sure to request The Plain Truth, and remember it's absolutely free. There is no charge. We'll get it in the mail to you as quickly as we receive your letter. There's never any bill to follow. We would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.